How do we find real masculinity with Jesus hanging on a cross? The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for April is titled Man Up, The Quest for Masculinity. It's written by regular guest Pastor Jeff Hemmer. You can find out more at issuesetc.org or call Concordia Publishing House 1-800-325-3040. Men in all stages of life will appreciate Man Up. The Issues Etc. Book of the Month, Man Up, 1-800-325-3040. If you were to believe how things are covered in the news or how things are reported to us usually here in the early part of the 21st century, you would probably think that there is little evidence for the claims made in the Bible, Old and New Testament. Real evidence, the kind of stuff that you can dig up, say, in an archaeological dig. And the little evidence that does exist is shaky and flimsy and maybe, maybe not kind of stuff. But that's not true. In fact, the record of biblical archaeology in confirming the truth claims of Holy Scripture, where it has, is amazing. And it might surprise you to learn that biblical archaeology has not uncovered a single bit of evidence to disprove a truth claim in the Bible. To say, no, this absolutely did not happen. And the more they dig, the more they find. And the more they find, the more they find that what Scripture says happened did actually happen. Greetings and welcome back to Issues Etc., coming to you from the studios of Lutheran Public Radio in Collinsville, Illinois. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. We're going to be listening to Dr. Paul Meyer making the case for biblical archaeology from the 2015 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference. He's Professor Emeritus of Ancient History at Western Michigan University in Kalamazoo, author of several books, including In the Fullness of Time, A Historian Looks at Christmas, Easter, and the Early Church, Josephus, The Essential Works, Eusebius, The Church History, and his latest publication, The Constantine Codex. Here's Dr. Paul Meyer making the case for biblical archaeology.
When it comes to archaeology, of course, we have here one of the very important proof platforms for the Christian faith, because, you know, archaeology and its evidence really takes first place, doesn't it? Words can be changed across the centuries, their meanings altered, but when it comes to material, hard evidence from the ground, this takes first place. And everybody, of course, has some wrong ideas about archaeology. They conclude, of course, it's an old discipline because it's dealing with the dust of the past. They even have sympathy for the poor archaeologist because his career is in ruins. Not too good, not too good. Okay. All right, here's the chaser. Here it is. Ladies, we have so many lovely young ladies here too. Try to marry an archaeologist because the older you get, the greater interest your husband will take in you. Yeah. However, archaeology is a young discipline. It is only about 125, 135 years old. Modern scientific archaeology does not come along until late 1870, probably with the excavation of Troy under Schliemann. And ever since then, of course, it's been a hot topic, front and center. But to show you the biased attitude of the German higher critics, when archaeology came along and was supporting a conservative viewpoint, pointing out that the things in the Bible, the things you're liable to read in the Bible, they aren't necessarily true, unlike Porgy and Bess, that they said, oh, untried discipline. It doesn't agree with our findings, therefore probably it's specious. You know, I mean, what a crazy attitude they had. Archaeology had a hard time back in the 1870s, 80s, getting a hearing. because it was such a new and untried discipline, according to those who are trying to sabotage the biblical record. Nobody would say that today, but they're desperately trying at places to bias archaeology in the sense of non-biblical, cut down any bridges between the hard evidence and the biblical evidence. We have, in fact, as you may know, for readers of BAR, Biblical Archaeology Review, the biblical minimalists and the biblical maximalists. The biblical maximalists are conservatives who appreciate the tremendous finds being made archaeologically and how beautifully they do support the biblical record 9 out of 10 times. William Foxwell Albright, the great professor of Semitics at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, would be a case in point. He virtually invented biblical archaeology per se. But a big debate persists even as to whether or not that's a proper term. William Deaver, for example, University of Arizona, used to object to the term. He says, well, wait a minute, let's just call it archaeology. Why delimit it? It almost looks as though you're trying to make it exclusive for the purpose of biblical research. And then others say, no, it's only a purview area. You can speak of American Indian archaeology, can't you? You know, so it's a territorial thing. So I would disagree then with Deaver's approach and simply say it's okay if you want to concentrate on the archaeology of the Near and Middle East and areas that do impinge on the biblical record. At that area, you know, you're not doing stuff with the Olmec Indians and south of the Texas border when you're dealing with that. But the other debate rages between the maximalists and the minimalists. The minimalists are possibly the most biased crew I have ever come across, and they probably should take away their licenses to do archaeology. They are so hopelessly biased against the Bible, they will automatically see what the Bible says and then try to contradict it, if possible, by finding what they can in the good earth. The leaders are two guys who ought to know better at the University of Copenhagen, Lemche and Thompson. They're the aces of biblical minimalists. They try to cut down any connection between what you find in the hard earth and the results and anything in the Bible. They claim, for example, another one in Israel is Israel Finkelstein. Israel Finkelstein loves to cut off the limb in which he's sitting. A lot of these biblical critics do too, as a matter of fact. You know, what I can't understand is these people who lose their faith. Why don't they go sell shoes after that? Or life insurance, or marketing, or go into finance? Why do they have to then stay in religion? Time and again, you find that the worst biblical critics are those who have had a fierce, austere, fundamentalist upbringing. They went to Bob Jones University in Greenville, South Carolina, or something like that. A case in point would be Bart Ehrman, the omnipresent, loud voice who was constantly railing against the variations in the texts in the New Testament. I tell you, Bart Ehrman has made more snow-capped mountains out of the lowest little flat molehills you ever find. He will tell you that if God inspired scriptures, then he should have inspired every last copyist copying scriptures. Therefore, you shouldn't have to have a critical apparatus in the base of your Greek New Testament, for example. And any pastor will show you his Nestle's Greek New Testament. At the bottom of every page, there's about 20% of the page which has critical apparatus, meaning the great Unschill manuscripts say it this way, but later on when you get to the papyri, they will adjust this and have it slightly different. Yeah, you're going to find copious variations. Not much, not any that has in any way affected the text at all or any Christian doctrine, but errare humanum est, and so you're going to find some texts that are a little bit different. And the job of the textual critic is to try to get back to what we call the original autographs. And this really belongs to this morning's lecture. Let me just finish off this thing before we get back to archaeology. But that's the job of the textual critic. And because we have more Greek manuscripts of the New Testament than any other document that's ever come down to us anywhere in the history of the world, we're able, because of textual criticism, which is good, to get better and better and better back to exactly the original reading. There are rules for how to do it properly. And let me just give you an example of the incidents. When the KJV, the Authorized Version, the King James Version was published in 1611, they had basically six major manuscript traditions of the New Testament. When Luther translated his beautiful version of the New Testament into German at the Wartburg, he primarily had Erasmus's great new Textus Receptus, his authorized text. But the King James people now had six. And when the AV was published in 1870, authorized version again, we had 2,000 Greek manuscripts in whole or in part. Today, 5,000, almost 800 Greek texts and manuscripts in whole or in part of the New Testament have been recovered. Now, this is terrific in terms of textual criticism to get back the original text. But naturally, with slight errors and permutations and combinations, Ehrman's right in saying there are probably more variations than words in the New Testament, to which we say, so what? It matters not at all, because you can see the essence of your latest biblical translations read very much like the King James Version. Not to worry, no problem there. It's just a ridiculous thing that Ehrman is using all the time, bragging of the fact, of course, that he's in the buckle of the Bible Belt, and he is the chairman of the religion department at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill, and indeed, he's an atheist or agnostic. However, he does believe that Jesus did exist. Isn't that nice of him? Oh, man, I tell you, so kind.
We'll hear more from Dr. Paul Meyer, Professor Emeritus of Ancient History at Western Michigan University in Kalamazoo, from his 2015 Issues, Etc., Making the Case conference. He's going to continue his discussion of that segment of biblical archaeologists who are dedicated to debunking the Bible. We'll be right back.
Did you know that Luther Academy has been providing continuing education for confessional Lutheran pastors and laypeople worldwide for more than 20 years? Luther Academy publishes Logia, the Confessional Lutheran Dogmatics series, and Luther Digest. Find out more about Luther Academy and sign up to receive their free email newsletter at lutheracademy.com, lutheracademy.com, and like them on Facebook, facebook.com/lutheracademy.
Tired of mommy bloggers telling you Lent is about simplifying your life? Totally over the History Channel speculating on whether or not Jesus' skin was olive or white? Check out the April The Lutheran Witness. We're talking Lent, Easter, and Jesus, who hangs on a cross for you, lies in a tomb for you, and is risen and returning all for you. Visit cph.org/try-Lutheran-witness for a special offer of 6 issues for $6.99. The Lutheran Witness, interpreting the contemporary world from a Lutheran perspective.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
The Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld His glory, glory as of the only Son from the Father, full of grace and truth.
At Advent Lutheran Church in Zionsville, Indiana, God's Word and sacraments work to forgive sinners through the gospel of Jesus Christ. We invite you to join the rich heritage of traditional liturgy in our Sunday morning worship.
You can find us online at adventlutheran.org.
Dr. Anthony Eslin will be speaking on the topic of imagination and education at the second annual Wittenberg Academy Family Retreat, which will be held at Camp Okoboji in Milford, Iowa on April 27th through the 29th, 2017. Join us and be immersed in God's Word, thoughtful discussions, and family fun. For more information or to register, visit www.wittenbergacademy.org and click on the registration tab.
Welcome back. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. We're listening to the 2015 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference presentation by Dr. Paul Meyer. He's making the case for biblical archaeology. And let's go back. He's continuing his discussion of those biblical archaeologists who have dedicated themselves to debunking the biblical narrative.
But anyway, the same thing now happens in archaeology. You have some people dedicated against any possible link. Lemke and Thompson are a case in point. And this article I referred to in Harper's Magazine about false testament is another one by an Israel Finkelstein plugged heavily into that one. Now let me tell you about his methodology. You're going to find some disagreement among archaeologists in terms of your time grid. Now, Israel Finkelstein's time grid's 100 years off everybody else's. And so he concludes that in the archaeology of Jerusalem, for example, all the great items credited to David in Jerusalem really belong to Ahab of the 10 northern tribes instead. Hello, Ahab comes 100 years after David, doesn't he? Garbage in, garbage out. That's it. Load the correct data into a wrong program, you get garbage. Load the incorrect data into a good program, and you get garbage. And that's exactly what happens here. So your biblical minimalists pretty well, I think, have sung their siren song because their bias is so openly obvious. It's just kind of disgusting. Scholars are supposed to do this open-minded. Archaeology takes place when you let the chips fall where they may. If somebody goes overseas with his spade to prove the Bible, nice idea, but take his spade away from him. If somebody goes overseas with a spade to disprove the Bible, take his spade away from him. You dig for the truth, let the chips fall where they may. What's neat about the chips are the number that incline in the direction of rather beautifully and rather immediately supporting the biblical account. Again and again we find this. And so Foxwell Albright was not wrong in coining the term biblical archaeology. Herschel Shanks, the present Jewish editor of BAR, knows primarily where his bread is buttered, and so he's very actively objective in terms of his larger Christian subscription and does a very fair job, and he inclines toward the use of the term too. Nothing wrong with it. There are, however, hazards in terms of any archaeological excavation. You have to watch out for fraud. That has happened. Just like in anthropology, the Piltdown skull derailed anthropology, human anthropology, for about five decades until they saw that it was a preposterous hoax. You're going to find occasionally things like that in archaeology as well. In Skeleton in God's Closet, it's a terrible hoax. I won't even report it. Again, remember, I don't know the author. You're also going to find the problems of war. Just imagine some of the treasures that have been lost archaeologically in Iraq because of ISIS taking over at places. Or in Afghanistan, the Taliban, ruining archaeological treasures. These can't be replaced. It's been estimated that only 80% of the Baghdad Museum has been restored. These are probably endless losses. Terrible things are happening. Or you might find weather involved, or if not protected right, or thievery is a big problem. Oh, man, poor archaeologists discovering treasure will never let it be known. Or if they define human remains, oh, man, you got to keep that away from the Hasidics in Jerusalem. That would be what the Pharisees would be like today in terms of a real conservative group. They don't want any human remains in any way touched. So you got to sometimes use shams to get around from under their noses. There's all kinds of problems involved. territorial disputes, nationalistic intervention. For example, let me give you another case in point. The Ebla discoveries. About 25 years ago, 30 years ago, the tablets at Ebla, Tel Mardik in Syria, were discovered. And this is a fabulous discovery because before this, pretty well between Mesopotamia in the east and Egypt in the southwest, there was nothing except desert, they thought. Until they decided to dig into this great mound 30 miles south of Aleppo in Syria, where all the horror takes place now. And in this great mound called Tel Mardik, they thought it was a medieval Arab mound because it was still a tremendous tell dominating the countryside. And so they had to be new, they thought, until they started excavating it and they found out, my gosh, this was the capital of ancient Ebla 2000 BC. The thing's only 4,000 years old, not medieval. Indeed exposes the Eblaite civilization, which is mentioned in the Old Testament and also mentioned in Sumerian records. And that's the only two places that Ebla was ever mentioned. But the sixth king of the Eblaites was named Eber. And he is the eponymous ancestor of the Eberus. I think you pronounce them Hebrews. And this, of course, got the goat of the Syrian government, because now they think Israel's going to claim that territory too. You know, and so there's a terrible dispute then between Paolo Mattei, the archaeologist who discovered it, and the epigrapher there, who deciphered it, and the Syrian government, and Mattei didn't want to do any more archaeology there, and it just keeps going. Nationalistic intervention, you got to watch out for that. I wish I could report an ancient Ebla. It's going to take 50 years to translate all those 15,000 tablets they discovered there in Eblaite, and really this has quadrupled our epigraphical information from the 3rd millennium B.C., four times as much as we now have from the year 3000 to 2000 BC because of that one discovery. So I kid you not, stay tuned. The discoveries are coming left and right. It's an exciting time to be alive and to argue against any correlation between what's found in the ground over there and what's in the Bible is futile, useless, and horrendously wrong headed. Again, that Copenhagen school ought to be closed down. I mean, it's just worthless. And of course, all your students eagerly studying under them are quite convinced that their professors are the truth. And so you have a whole crowd being spawned again in the field of archaeology, trying to blow up and demolish, as it were, any discoveries. Now, here's the problem. When you excavate a mound, usually dig a kind of test trench to see what the strata will show. And then you favor one or another strata. It's a real problem as to what to do. Generally, Israelis and Americans kind of like to favor the biblical strata, but other ones that are further on top, therefore younger, or maybe further down below, would be regarded by some people as equally important. Nevertheless, let's take Jericho as a case in point, okay? We all know about Jericho. We all know about Joshua at the Battle of Jericho and so forth. The principal excavator at Jericho was Dame Kathleen Kenyon. For many decades, she dug there, and she is the doyen, the female dean, you might say, of all biblical archaeologists, and they all use Kenyon's bulk debris method, which is an interesting thing by which, when she's clearing a spot archaeologically, she always leaves one of these bulks standing with all the strata intact therein, untouched, so that later on, when even better archaeological methods are discovered, they can go back and then even redo some of her work around the edges to see more exactingly when these things took place. So it's a neat idea, nothing wrong with it. And indeed, it was her husband, I think, who coined that bad joke I gave you, the older you get, your greater husband's interest, your husband will take in you. Maybe it happened in his case, I don't know. But in any case, what about Jericho? Now, when Dame Kathleen dug there. She always is very critical of the biblical result because she found no indication that at that time any walls came down. And it all depends on your dating for the siege of Jericho. Is it 1400 BC or 1230? And there's a big debate, still rages. I'm not sure the thing has been solved over there, but as to when the Israelites entered the promised land. And was it a normal invasion, a la the scriptures, or more of a peaceful infiltration, which is another version archaeologically as well. Anyway, Dame Kathleen could not find any evidence to support the biblical record there. But let's remember again that even though the excavations of old Jericho, and indeed they're very impressive, and she found a Neolithic watchtower there from about 6,000 BC or so, that's before the patriarchal era, I need not tell you, and so it didn't apply, but nevertheless, she kind of contradicted the biblical record. But the point is, she said two reasons. One, she didn't find cascading walls. And the other is she didn't find a particular kind of pottery that should have been there around 1230 BC or so, if it happened then. Well, Bryant Wood redid her work many years later and dug at a different spot. What do you know? He found that pottery. Yeah. He also found cascading wall remains. So again, see what happens is probably in most of these tells, less than 1% or 2% is excavated, and then the archaeologists there extrapolate immediately for the whole tell. And that doesn't work, because obviously you're going to miss things. Another problem with not true archaeology is cherry-picking. There's a lot of cherry-picking going on. I need to tell you Bill O'Reilly's Killing Jesus. Oh, the cherry picker, man. He's constantly, you know, picking what he wants and avoiding what he doesn't. Making sensational statements. Jesus could not have talked from the cross. Of course he could. And so on, you know. And he spent 8 months researching that book. Others spent a lifetime, never mind that. Or the book was mostly ghostwritten by that Dugard, you know, also author. Names appear real small. I'm not knocking O'Reilly per se, and so I even agree with some of the stuff he says. But in terms of biblical scholarship, maybe, you know, let's not have amateur hour here, okay? Yeah. In any case, so you have to be careful of all these claims being made. And, you know, they're coming almost every week, if not every month. And you have to watch out for claims of Red Sea crossings and pictures of Pharaoh's chariot wheels, so clearly they look like they were minted a year earlier. You know, watch out. Remember the old rule, too good to be true. And in many senses, some of these are too good to be true. And so you have to watch out for fraud regularly.
That's good advice. Skepticism is always in order when dealing with biblical archaeology and the profit motive connected to it. What else should we be concerned about? We're listening to Dr. Paul Meyer, Making the Case for Biblical Archaeology from the 2015 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
There's a dangerous movement in evangelicalism known as the New Apostolic Reformation, and they literally claim that in the past few decades, God has restored apostles and prophets to the church.
Chris Rosebro talking about his presentation at this summer's Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
In my presentation, I'll be making the case against modern-day apostles and prophets. As part of the presentation, we'll be talking about who's teaching this ecclesiology, the inherent dangers of it, but also what's at the root of it, and that is a false understanding of the baptism of the Holy Spirit.
You can meet and hear Chris Rosebro making the case against modern-day prophets and apostles Friday, June 9th and Saturday, June 10th at the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference in Collinsville, Illinois. For more information, visit issuesetc.org or call 618-223-8255. 8385, the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
Memoria Press invites all Issues Etc. listeners to explore our Simply Classical curriculum, a set of full-year academic curriculum packages for children with learning challenges. Our classical writing program and our Christian studies are now based on your favorite CPH Bible storybooks. To learn more, visit classicalspecialneeds.com and use promo code LPR to save on your initial purchase. That's classicalspecialneeds.com.
The world may tell us that Easter is about eggs and chocolate bunnies, but we Christians know that there would be no Easter without Jesus' death and resurrection. Emmanuel Press has just released an Easter card with beautiful artwork that confesses Christ's victory over death and his redemption of mankind. You can find this card and others at emmanuelpress.us, E-M-M-A-N-U-E-L press.us.
The radio voice of the Lutheran faith for the 21st century, you're listening to Issues Etc.
Metro East Lutheran High School in Edwardsville, Illinois, engages young adults in a Christ-centered environment, delivering academic excellence and spiritual growth to develop Christian leaders for tomorrow. We provide a Christ-focused alternative to public high schools. Many of our students receive tuition assistance. To help us provide tuition assistance to more students, go to melhs.org and click on the giving page, or call me, Dr. J. Krause, principal, at 618-656-0043.
At Concordia University Irvine, you can pursue advanced theological study for academic, professional, or personal development. Concordia's Master of Arts in Theology program is grounded in the truth of Scripture and insights from the Lutheran Confessions. Courses are taught online and at intensive on-campus sessions in the summer. Apologetics, Christian education leadership, and Reformation studies are just a few of the emphases offered. For more information, visit cui.edu/theology. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're listening to Dr. Paul Meyer make the case for biblical archaeology at the 2015 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference. He's Professor Emeritus of Ancient History at Western Michigan University in Kalamazoo, author of several books, including In the Fullness of Time, A Historian Looks at Christmas, Easter, and the Early Church, Josephus, The Essential Works, Eusebius, The Church History, and his latest publication, The Constantine Codex. One of the less-known features of the Issues Etc. Making the Case conferences are the worship opportunities. We conclude Friday night with Compline, prayer at the close of day. We begin Saturday with morning prayer, and we wrap up the Making the Case conference Saturday night with the Divine Service, where I have the privilege of preaching. This summer's conference is Friday, June the 9th and Saturday, June the 10th in Collinsville, Illinois, about 15 miles east of St. Louis. Find out more and register for the premier conference for Christian laity, the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, June 9th and 10th in Collinsville, Illinois, at issuesetc.org. Let's go back to the audio of Dr. Paul Meyer at the 2015 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference. What else do we watch out for in biblical archaeology besides fraud?
You also have to keep a good sense of vision as to where your sources are coming from. Some of the frauds lately are really ingenious. Boy, one that took me away for a while was a new witness on Jesus' miracles from Marcus Velius Paterculus. I don't know if you remember that one. Came over the computer blogs. This is a neat one. Now, I knew all about Velius Paterculus as one of the Roman authors of a fulsome, flattery biography of Tiberius the emperor. And I knew all about his trip to Parthia in 31 A.D., which he took, and then reported in the way a Vatican Curia advisor found this in the Vatican Library in the great 2nd century A.D. collection. Anytime you come to a museum and they find a document 2nd century, no, that's the catch-all. For some, it could be even earlier. And so the 2nd century documentation is very important. So he found there fragments of Velius's own travelogue in which he reports that on his way back from Parthia, he stopped at a place called Samaria. And while he was there, Some teacher from Galilee named Yesu de Nazareth, sound familiar? A man who could preach with authority came with his following. And this is kind of a neat miracle. Cured a stillborn baby and gave life to it and gave him back to his mama. Now, at first, I was like elated. First of all, it agreed with my chronology. And that is that Jesus had to be crucified in 33 and not the year 30. I love that. But the other point is I failed to look at the source, which was an Irish humor magazine. Hello, I was taken in totally. But there was such painstaking work done. The guy had, you know, a hand drawing of what Velius looked like. And I guess, remember the Greek hoax, the giant? That crazy thing, remember, made the computer rounds, a couple years ago. I don't know why they spent so much time on this. They unearthed a giant to help prove Genesis 5 or something like that. Giants in the earth in those days. The guy was about 16 feet long. And it looked like, you know, a real carcass, you know. But that was all a hoax, too. They showed you on the map where it took place. Unbelievable. So watch out for this stuff. There's one of these archaeologists. I won't mention his name. I don't want to. He's passed on now, but... But this guy invented everything. Ben Wyatt, okay, I'll tell you, who has discovered everything that still needed discovering, you know, in the Bible. And he found the chariots in the Red Sea. He found Pharaoh's son drowned or something. I'm sorry, he did not. So watch out for the, there's another funny one just this past week. I don't know if you got it on your computer, but I didn't mind, about a Muslim was bewailing the fact that the College of Cardinals meeting in Rome had officially just about given up on Jesus' second coming. Hasn't shown up yet. We doubt that he's going to make it. I said, wait a minute. So I talked to good Catholic friends. I said, this is impossible, is it? Or has Pope Francis done it to us again? Imagine that name for a Pope, Francis. Unbelievable. Innocent III, the most powerful pope who ever lived in the 1200s. And at the other end of the scale, humbly from Assisi, was St. Francis. So no pope has ever used that name until a fellow who likes to drive a 20-year-old car and live in Rome. But that's Francis. Okay, anyway. Turns out that this was also, I think, in a Scottish humor magazine. But the Arab, through the Quran, believes in Jesus' second coming. So he was objecting to the Christians losing their faith. Hello, I had to get back to this guy quickly and explain the background. So these hoaxes are running thick and fast. You got to watch out for them. Please consider the source in every case. So these are some of the hazards we have to avoid. The best discovery is an accidental discovery, because then you know it is. Most of the time, it's not planted ahead of time. Now, the discoveries you can't trust would be the ones I just mentioned. And I loved when I don't want to knock China, but the Chinese Christian Noah's Ark Society set out to the mountains of Ararat to discover what? Noah's Ark. How do you like that? Name yourself for what you want to find. And of course they found it. Or so they claim. You know, it's just naive. How naive can you get? I'm often asked when I take over a Bible class, we have Q&A, a lot of fun. I'm always asked two ark questions, you know, Noah's and of the covenant, right? And every time I ask, when they ask about, has Noah's ark been discovered? My answer is, yes, in my lifetime alone, it's been discovered 34 times. And I didn't know that Noah had such a navy, man. And I usually always add, but we do know something new, the name of Noah's wife, which is not in the Bible. It was Joan. Joan of Arc, yeah. So don't name yourself for what you want to find. Accidental discoveries are the ones that count. The reason, again, you know, now what amazes me are some of the discoveries that have been made, and they're usually always accidental. Now, in the Old, let's do it logically, Old Testament first and New Testament. Please don't think that just because the Old Testament is older that therefore we're not going to find correlations. We wish we had more in the case of the sojourn in Egypt. Yeah. My first question when I see Moses in heaven is, hey, fella, would you please give us the name of the Pharaoh next time? Not just the title, okay? You know, later on, they name pharaohs, Pharaoh Necho, Pharaoh Shishak, and so forth. But to give only the office name is somewhat problematical. And, you know, how many forests of trees have been taken down for paper pulp, for the hundreds of books that have been written on which pharaoh was the pharaoh of the oppression and which the pharaoh of the Exodus and so on. So it would have been helpful. However, this is not to say, as Lemke and Thompson would, that there was no Israelite sojourn in Egypt. No, that's far beyond the conclusion that you would draw there. But yeah, and again, all those chapters in Genesis that do refer to Egypt do refer indeed to Egyptian customs and officials, and so it all does ring true, after all, no question about it. And Israel is not without mention in Egyptian records. The Merneptah stele, what's a stele? That's a sign like this, rounded at the top usually, a slab on which a sign is written. And Merneptah is bragging about his conquests in Asia Minor. And in the Merneptah stele, it says, Israel, his seed is not. In other words, he probably says he conquered them. Even if he didn't, never mind. Egyptians don't mind lying on their stele. And you're going to find things like the Misha stone, the Moabite king. Remember when Israel conquers Moab on the way into the promised land? And how on the Misha stone, he says, or the Moabite stone, he says that for a while their God abandoned them because Israel had come along and conquered them. But now, you know, by sacrificing his own son or something, he's now going to, again, be kind to us Moabites and whatever. Exactly correlating with what we find in the Old Testament. Again and again and again and again this happens.
You're listening to Dr. Paul Meyer, Professor Emeritus of Ancient History at Western Michigan University in Kalamazoo, making the case for biblical archaeology at the 2015 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference. When we come back, more correlation between the biblical record and biblical archaeology.
Emily finally had to face the truth. Her church choir was a mess.
Katie Schuerman from her new audiobook, House of Living Stones.
Sure, they'd managed to turn out a few decent choral offerings for Sunday worship every now and then, but their confidence and morale were presently hanging lower than pants on a wrapper.
You can purchase and download an audio version of the novel House of Living Stones at Amazon, Audible, and iTunes. House of Living Stones by Katie Schuerman.
Are you tired of working nights, weekends, and odd hours trying to cover your bases at home just to make ends meet? At the Cleaning Authority, we call that the multi-job shuffle, and we want to end that for you right now. We'll train you in our proven, efficient cleaning methods, and you'll be partnered to work in pre-qualified homes. Call 314-416-8117 and walk away from the multi-job shuffle with a future in our St. Louis office, 314-416-8117.
Real Reformation Radio. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Our school is committed to authentic Lutheranism, the entire Book of Concord, and indeed to authentic Lutheranism as it has continued to be confessed and practiced through the centuries right up into our own time.
Dr. Cameron McKenzie, Chairman of the Department of Historical Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana.
We're committed then to biblical, confessional Christianity and Lutheranism and applying it to the world of today in as effective a way as we can.
You can find out more about studying for the pastoral ministry at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, at ctsfw.edu, ctsfw.edu, or call 1-800-481-2155. Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. Welcome back. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. On this Easter Monday, April the 17th, we're listening to Dr. Paul Meyer, a regular guest, making the case for biblical archaeology from the 2015 Issues Etc. Making the Case conference. Let's go back. He's talking about the repeated correlation between biblical archaeology and the biblical record.
And when it comes to the kings, a united monarchy, nobody's questioned about the fact that the Philistines were there. They're all realistic terms. David's name had never been discovered, and so that's one reason the biblical minimalists were trying to say there never was a David. Or if there was, he was only a captain of a little hilltop group in Judea. Well, too bad. Benjamin Mazar, I'm sorry, no, it was... Peter Glock, who was it? And anyway, it was some relative of Mazar is the dean of the archaeologists. He discovered it, Avran Biran, at Tel Dan in northern Syria. He found a victory stele in which Asa, king of a Jew, a king of the house of David in Judah, yeah, conquers Baasha, king of Israel, with the help of Ben-Hadad of Syria. They brag about it, but of the house of David, hello. Dawid shows up then for the first time archaeologically, and I'm sure as more excavations take place, Eilat Mazar, the grandniece of Benjamin, is digging in Jerusalem, is quite sure she's found a wall of David's palace in Jerusalem. People, stay tuned. There will be additional dramatic archaeological discoveries, which, if passed as any precedent or example, will impinge directly and favorably on the biblical record. It is happening right under our noses. Now, tell me why the biblical minimalists refuse to grant credibility to Saul or Jonathan or David, but suddenly, when we get to either Ahab and then further down to Hezekiah, they all shut up. No longer are they criticizing king lists. You know why? There's just too much archaeology, that's why. As you well know, Hezekiah, the famous fellow who got 15 more years by praying for it, remember that one? 700 BC, time of Isaiah, is in charge of Judah at the time that the ten northern tribes have fallen to the conquering Assyrians in 722. And remember, Sennacherib then comes down to Jerusalem and besieges Hezekiah. And according to the Sennacherib prism, a hexagonal thing, which stands at the University of Chicago in Illinois, which is a record of his invasion of Israel and Judah. And he proudly says on the Sennacherib prism, "I shut King Hezekiah up in Jerusalem like a caged bird," implying he was victorious. Now, if you read the Old Testament, we have quite a different view. And that is, the angel of the Lord smote 35,000 Assyrian troops at night, and they fled back to Assyria from which they had come. Remember? Now, I'd say it's quite a different view, huh? So who's to decide? I called a witness, the father the father of history, Herodotus himself, Halicarnassus, the great Greek historian, 425 BC, his death. Herodotus says when he was down in Egypt, he heard exactly what happened at the siege of Jerusalem. The night before Sennacherib's planned final assault, a horde of desert vermin, rats and mice, crawled out of the desert and ate away all of the leather thongs that held the Assyrian helmets and shields together, and they were left defenseless and fled the country. I'd say that's closer to the biblical view, wouldn't you? You know, so again, even though the documentation is there, don't always believe it. So you got to watch, you know, what the ancient claims are. But the idea of people like Jehu showing up, remember the furious driver? He kneels before Shalmaneser III in the great Assyrian relief, which you can see today in the British Museum in London. These people come to life in stone, let me tell you. Nobody's guessing around with these figures. I told you there are 50 famous names in the Old Testament that strut their stuff not only in the Bible, but in secular history as well. And it accords perfectly with what we know about all this. And then I mentioned the Cyrus inscription. Now, remember Cyrus. What a guy. I mean, he comes out favorably both in pagan literature and in Christian literature and in Jewish literature. It's kind of hard to do. Cyrus the Great, Kurish the Great, who turned the tables on the Medes who were in control and the Persians took over, created the Persian Empire. He was also a very tolerant personality. He heard about the Hebrews and their belief in one God, didn't stop them. And he permitted Ezra and the others to go back to Jerusalem and to rebuild the temple. And Cyrus also told the neighbors to help the Hebrews rebuild the temple, remember? Well, the great edict of restitution and the great edict of emancipation is written in the Old Testament. And we found it, I wasn't there, except that the archaeologists found it, on what looks like a pregnant corn cob. Now, you see, they wrote on anything they wanted. You know, sometimes in a flat statue, a stele, I should say, a monument like that, or on oblong tablets, always horizontally. And this thing looks like a corn cob, fat in the middle. And there you have Cyrus's edict discovered, almost in the same words as the Old Testament. So who's doubting this? And then 2 centuries earlier, I didn't finish Hezekiah's part. Nobody, not even Lempsche or Thompson or the Copenhagen people, would doubt that there was a Hezekiah. You know why? His name shows up in stone at the end of his tunnel in Jerusalem, where he can walk through it today. And here you have the history of the tunnel. He's very proud of it, Hezekiah is. What he did was this, clever idea. James Michener used it later for his book, The Source. There's a spring there called the Virgin Spring, or the Gihon Spring, where Solomon was anointed, by the way. Anyway, at that spring, it's outside the city walls of Jerusalem, but it produces wonderful water. So Hezekiah has this idea, why should the Assyrians come here and find much water? And so he carefully camouflaged that source and then built a tunnel from that spring under the city walls of Jerusalem and then had it flow into the pools of Siloam, okay? And indeed it worked. That's how Hezekiah could keep the Assyrians out, caged bird or not. Okay, but at the end of that tunnel, where the Siloam tunnel ends, there is a sign about this big with Hezekiah's name on it. It's called the tunnel, and this is the history of the tunnel. When I, Hezekiah, wanted to so-and-so, he talked about 2 teams of workmen beginning at both ends and heading toward each other. And when they got to each other, they were only about 5 feet off. That's great engineering. And you can go through that tunnel today. And indeed, you can come to that one point where you see the pick marks going this way and the pick marks going the other way is where the tunnel was joined. And it records that. So no archaeologist, however biased, is going to doubt that there was a Hezekiah. Hello, his name shows up in stone, okay? And from that point on, there's no doubt. So my question to these people always is, why suddenly doubted these immaterial kings who never existed suddenly take on reality? Pray tell. Yeah, and so it goes.
More with Dr. Paul Meyer, Professor Emeritus of Ancient History at Western Michigan University in Kalamazoo, from his 2015 Issues, Etc. Making the Case Conference, making the case for biblical archaeology on the other side of the break. Folks, it is vitally important that our children and grandchildren are equipped to defend and teach the truths of Christianity on the college campus, and LCMSU is an initiative that connects and supports Lutheran students as they head off to college and face countless challenges to their biblical worldview, doctrine, ethics, and practices. Find out more at lcms.org/lcmsu.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Throughout the 50 days of Easter, sacred music for the world. LutheranPublicRadio.org. Listen 24/7 to sacred music for the Easter season. LPR, LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Good Shepherd Lutheran Church in Collinsville, Illinois is happy to support the Christ-centered, cross-focused ministry of Issues, Etc. Join us for worship, Bible classes, youth ministry, and other opportunities to grow in Christ. We have a Christian day school for children in preschool to eighth grade. We are located at 1300 Beltline Road. Call us at 618-344-3151 or visit www.goodshepherdcollinsville.org.
Your pastor has been called to shepherd you as a member of Christ's flock. Doxology offers an innovative program of advanced study retreats where your pastor can be refreshed, renewed, and refocused. Find out more at doxology.us. Many pastors report that doxology has been one of the most valuable learning experiences since seminary. Doxology, the Lutheran Center for Spiritual Care and Counsel. Doxology.us. Doxology.us.
College Preparation Station in Maryville, Illinois offers ACT, SAT, and PSAT test prep, scholarship application classes, college and career counseling, and more. Hi, this is Lori Konski, president of College Preparation Station. We have helped our students obtain more than $7 million in tuition scholarships in 12 years. Find out more at cpsprep.com. Let us help you create a vision and find your future. The College Preparation Station in Maryville, Illinois, cpsprep.com.
Welcome back. This is Issues Etc. We're listening to some audio from the 2015 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference. Dr. Paul Meyer making the case for biblical archaeology. Up to this point, he's talked largely about the Old Testament and the archaeological evidence. Now, Dr. Meyer moves on to the New Testament.
So these spectacular discoveries are being made. Let's move to the New Testament. There, of course, critics have tried every way possible, in a terrible bias, to try to undo the biblical record. They've tried geography, too, yeah. For instance, they claim that when Jesus and the disciples went to Caesarea Philippi, went to Tyre and Sidon ancient Phoenicia, that on the way back they took the wrong road. They took a longer road. Folks, the shortest road goes up over a mountain. You know, these shoot from the hip idiots, you know, who have not done their homework. Or another one is this. When they tried to push Jesus off a cliff at Nazareth, it's mythology because there's no cliff at Nazareth. Well, folks, who's been to Nazareth? Okay, you know what happens at the brink of the hill going down to the Valley of Jezreel? How many switchbacks does a tourist bus do to get up that 45-degree incline? About 6 or 7. That's enough cliff for me. Okay? It's not 90 degrees, but it is that. So, again, this kind of thing happens so often. Or some critic will claim, I've been on the Sea of Galilee 7 times, and I've never seen a wave over this high. How could there be a tempest? Well, of course, the guy's at a wrong season. doesn't understand the boats that ply the Sea of Galilee. They have hardly any freeboard. The whole idea is to get the nets in and out of the drink without having to go over a big, big 2 or 3 foot width of a ship. No, no, it's very low. And so really, any more than simple wave action is going to always pose a little hazard. So it's, again, you got to judge it by the fishing boat and whatever size. So this happens so often, and archaeologically as well, they're always trying to undermine. Why in the world can't they try to keep at least an open mind about what is discovered over there? I don't know. Methinks they doth protest too much. And this applies also to the evolutionists. You know, they desperately try to silence anybody who even breathes the idea of intelligent design. Or get them off the faculty. They've arranged that to have people fired because they dared to believe in an alternate approach. Methinks they doth protest too much. Are they running scared? Are they afraid of something? What happened to free inquiry? What happened to honest research? I don't know. It disappoints me terribly as to how fraught this field is. That should be so clean, so clear. And of course, there are so many archaeological sites. Oh man, in the case of the New Testament, you know, beginning with even structures. Even the Nativity gets into it. And not that they found the original manger, no. But hey, Church of the Nativity in Bethlehem, there's a lot of archaeology going for that one. They're, boy, oh boy. Whenever you have a site in the Holy Land, archaeological or otherwise, you always have to ask yourself, did it really happen here? And whenever I take a group over there, by the way, I have a 1 to 10 scale. 10 is absolutely authentic, and 1 is, why'd you ask a question like that? No, really. No, nicer than that. But I want to be known as a critical person. I hardly ever use a 10, except for the Sea of Galilee itself. I'll give that a 10, yeah. Mount of Olives, you know, this kind of thing. And I usually stand behind my guide while he's there, talking to my, we have to use a local guide, while he's talking to my group, and ask the group not to smile till the evening in the hotel. But you know, that Church of the Nativity in Bethlehem is probably worth an 8. It really is, because how far does a paper trail go back? You always have to check that in an archaeological site. How long is a church regarded this as the place? If it's a short time, I'm not interested. I'm always asked about the Shroud of Turin. I'm sorry, folks, I can't get interested in it because the paper trail does not go back far enough. Only goes back 6 centuries. I'm not trying to say that it's false. Not trying to say it's a fake. I don't know how the image transfer took place. Maybe it's real. But the paper trail doesn't go back far enough. Now, in contrast to that, Church of the Nativity go back 17 centuries. When Constantine the Great, first Christian emperor, wanted to erect a monument to where Jesus was born, he asked his architects contractors asked the Christian bishop of Jerusalem, did he know where Jesus was born? Oh, yeah, they had their Christmas picnic, sir. Bishop Makarios, he was the Blessed One. And he pointed out the place in Bethlehem where they knew it was the Grotto of the Nativity, where it was located, and that's why he built there. And you can see the Constantinian foundations of that structure there yet. And there are other references. Let's go back another century to Origen, one of the greatest theologians in the East. He says, whenever he went to Bethlehem there, even the pagans were willing to tell anyone who would listen where that great Jesus was born, who brought the pilgrims to Bethlehem and their money. Would they forget where the money tree was planted? I don't think so. I mean, this was their Eiffel Tower, their Colosseum, their Parthenon, their Acropolis. What would they forget? And then finally, we have Justin Martyr's own testimony, one of the great defenders of the faith, who was born next door to Jesus Galilee. Yeah. And he was born only 2 generations or 3 after Jesus. So I respect whatever Justin has to say. He said whenever he went to Bethlehem, he could point out the grotto or cavern where Jesus was born. Again, nobody says Jesus was born in an above-the-ground stable. He was born in a grotto or cave or cavern that was used as a stable because there was a manger there. And that's what you find not at your dining room table, but at a stable. Yeah. And under the high altar of the Church of the Nativity, there it is. So, you know, some of these things take on pretty powerful reality, even on a structural and archaeological basis. So as the discoveries are being made left and right, let me give you two champion examples. In the late 1800s, when the German higher critics again were going overboard, and by the way, I can criticize the German higher critics because my name is Maya, and that's very German as well, and therefore I can criticize my own. In any case, the English scholars have been much more friendly to the Bible, I will say that, than the German higher critics and the French higher critics, yeah. And by the way, to this day, I kid you not, ancient historians are much more favorable to the Bible as a source than our theological historians. Yeah, they're the ones who have to show that they're duly critical. They're the ones who have to go overboard and show how critical they can be. No, the ancient historians who are used to the handicaps of ancient source literature find the Bible material on a very high level by comparison. Yeah, they're much friendlier group. An interesting thing I discovered along the trail here. But anyway, the German higher critics, one of them was named Bruno Bauer. Now, he was a Lutheran theologian who made shipwreck of his faith. No, it was more like a general naval disaster. He said Jesus of Nazareth was not only not Son of God, that's a laugh. He wasn't even a human being. He never existed. He was the father of the, what I call the dehumanizer group that say that Jesus never lived. But even at the time, Bruno's colleagues were saying, well, wait a minute. Jesus was interviewed by Pontius Pilate. We all know Pontius Pilate existed from Josephus and from Philo and others. You know what Bruno Bauer's answer was? Yeah, those were interpolations. Somebody also added Pilate's name to those secular sources. Maybe the Christian monks through the Middle Ages who kept the manuscripts alive to make the New Testament look good. Too bad old Bruno wasn't at Caesarea Maritima, that is the Roman capital of Judea, on the Mediterranean. This is where Paul was 2 years in prison, remember? Too bad he wasn't around in 1961 when an Italian archaeological expedition was digging away at that waterfront palace of Herod and the theater there. And on the stair landing, they came across an oddly shaped 2-by-3-foot stone. And on a hunch, they pulled it out and turned it over because very often they will take an inscription and bury it to get rid of the writing and, you know, because they just want a nice plain stone surface. They lucked out. Here they had uncovered a cornerstone of a building Pontius Pilate put up in honor of the Emperor Tiberius. The Latin reads in 2-inch Latin lettering, Caesariensibus Tiberium Pontius Pilatus Praefectus Judei dated. Pontius Pilate, to the people of Caesarea, has presented the Tiberium in honor of the Emperor. Pontius Pilate, the prefect of Judea, has presented the Tiberium in honor of the emperor. So, you know, there you have now, can we call it hard evidence? Yeah, really hard evidence. I just wish old Bruno could have lived on for that moment rather than having gone on to his reward or whatever direction that was. I'll leave that one up to God. But I would have loved to have gotten that guy's head in an arm lock and rubbed that unbelieving nose of his in the inscription. And he could have learned via the Braille method alone that there was a Pontius Pilate. There it is, despite all his fulminations to the contrary. Thrilling discovery. Thrilling discovery. They have a model of it at Caesarea where it happens. And they have the original in the Israel Museum in West Jerusalem to the present day. Coins of Pontius Pilate. Pennies have been discovered, dating from the year 30, for example. Yeah, there's evidence all over the place. The remains of his aqueduct. Yeah, Pilate built an aqueduct to help furnish water supply for the city of Jerusalem. And he dug at the Pools of Solomon and then went under Bethlehem and then crossed the Hinnom Valley in a beautiful aqueduct and lining the southern face of the temple area in Jerusalem, the old city, is Pilate's aqueduct. And there are just so many other additional details in his life that are fascinating and help explain what's going on Good Friday. Again, we get so much extra evidence from the outside that it's a thrilling thing to see how beautifully historically based our faith is. Finally, I want to tell you about what I consider the most important discovery right along with the Dead Sea Scrolls in 1948. And I'm not talking about the Nag Hammadi codices discovered about the 47 the same time in Egypt, because these are only the Gnostic Gospels. We're not going to get into that. That'd take another hour lecture. Whenever you hear the term lost Gospels, don't fall for it. They're not lost anyway because you found them. And the other point is, don't believe Dan Brown's idea that they're really, you know, they should have been chosen instead of the real Gospels. Like there was some kind of a crapshoot going, March Madness. Now we're down to the Sweet 16, and there's the Elite Eight, and now let's get to the Big Four, Matthew, Mark, Luke. No, nothing like that at all. Nothing like that happened. The church had its eye on these false gospels 18 centuries ago when Irenaeus wrote a book against heresies, and he mentions things like the Judas gospel, even though we didn't hear about it till about 7-8 years ago. These things were known to the early church and how aberrant they were. Always they use the excuse, church and synagogue don't want you to read these because it'll destroy your faith. Doesn't apply at all. Now, how about the bones of the first biblical personality ever discovered came to light in November of 1990? Don't yell it out, but hands up for those who know what I'm talking about. That's amazing. Boy, this is a smart group. No, I can be talking to 300 pastors and teachers and ask if they know about the biblical bones, and only about 3% of the whole audience will know, professionals. Not blaming them. I'm blaming the world's press corps. This was not widely announced. To this day, it has not been widely announced, as witness the fact that 97 or 8% of you didn't raise your hands. Let me tell you about the bones of a personality that you have all heard of, especially every Lenten season. I'll give you a hint, he's a fella, not a girl. His bones were discovered in November 1990. Wasn't announced till 92, because they want to be sure that they were authentic before they announced it. Okay, here's the deal. A bulldozer is working south of the temple area in the old city of Jerusalem. I should immediately tell you, a bulldozer is not your average archaeological tool. Try brush, not archaeology, brush. Okay, the dozer was building a water park. Base blue plastic slides and all, yep. And suddenly found that it had collapsed into the roof of a burial cavern. Oh boy, so they turned off the diesels, called in the archaeologists. They shined their flashlights down in the hole. They didn't have to go even inside the place to date it. Yes. They said this is a first century, that is AD for us, CE for the rest of the world, first century burial site. How do they know that? Because there were 10 loculi with ossuaries in them. An ossuary is a limestone chest for burying bones. They're running out of space in the Mount of Olives. Looks like the end of Schindler's List, remember? Where you see all those graves in a row. Okay, well, that's 2,000 years earlier. They're running out of space. So now they decide to put a body in the sepulcher, let it decompose for a year or two, then gather the bones that remain and put them in one of these oblong limestone boxes. And so they pulled one of these out, and they were aghast because this box had been gloriously carved. Beautiful fluting around the edges, two giant rosettes cut in with sub-whorls. And I've never seen such beautiful workmanship on an ossuary. And then on the other side, of course, implying now, oh, there's got to be VIP inside there, right? And then on the other side, the VIP's name is inscribed. I'm going to give it to you. It was written twice. I'm going to give it to you in Aramaic. That's the language in which it was written. And I'll bet you can tease out who it is. Yosef Bar Caiapha. Yosef Bar Caiapha. Who does it sound like? Joseph Caiaphas, the high priest who indicted Jesus before the bar of Pontius Pilate on the morning of Good Friday. Major personality. Prosecution against Jesus on Good Friday. That's his bones. Thrilling discovery. Thrilling discovery. And they did all kinds of careful studies on it. Epigraphical, archaeological, in terms of seeing that it wasn't a fake. Now, paradoxically, the James ossuary is the one that's getting all the attention. And we're not even, look, that thing was empty, beaten around the antiquities market for 35 years before somebody looked at the inscription. And even there, there's a big controversy. Oded Golan, the owner, was indicted by the Israel Antiquities Authority in forgery, but not convicted. So we don't know if that thing's authentic or not. That was not an accidental discovery. This one was accidental. And that's what makes this one so much more important. So things like this are happening now. For the first time, the bones of a biblical personality. And how then can anyone dare doubt the Good Friday trial when we have all this massive evidence, internal and external? We have Joseph Caiaphas mentioned in all four Gospels. Lots of detail in Josephus. He tells us all about the house of Annas. Annas, kind of the gray eminence, the godfather of Jerusalem, the one pulling all the strings between a case of outrageous nepotism. Annas made high priest. Five of his sons made high priest. Never happened before or since. And the present incumbent, Joseph Caiaphas, number six, he married the boss's daughter. That was a way to get in those days. And has anything changed? You know. And so we have mentioned all four Gospels, mentioned in Josephus, mentioned also in Stone, there's his name, and his very bones. I mean, what more do they need? Pontius Pilate, mentioned in all four Gospels, mentioned in Tacitus, mentioned all over Josephus also in that time, and here's his name in stone. What more? What more do we need? Again, the case is not only, making the case is not only easy, but it's overwhelmingly easy. It's almost rudimentary. There is so much evidence out there. And I think there are so many, certainly non-Christians don't even know about this. And a lot of Christians don't know about it either. I just want you to know how incredibly, beautifully, heavily, adequately our faith is supported by the hard evidence out there. There are so many other things you could point out. The structures. The Pool of Siloam today. Remember the end of Hezekiah's tunnel? That's only a catch basin. We were shown the wrong Pool of Siloam. Now they've discovered the true pool further down the Silwan or Siloam Valley, not far away, which is much bigger. That this is where indeed Jesus told the blind man to wash, remember? And he regained his sight. Or the Bethesda, the Pool of Bethesda, it's there. And so many other things. My goodness, the whole palace of Herod at the western part of the city where the trial took place. We can show you the stones in the Tower of Phasael that witnessed Jesus' trial. Oh yeah, absolutely. The main Roman drag, the Cardo, that goes north to the Damascus Gate is still there, despite the fact that Jerusalem has been destroyed and rebuilt 13 times since Jesus' day. So today it's higher. Today Jerusalem is about 15 to 20 feet higher than in Jesus' day, because each destruction layer means a new base from which you build. That base gets higher and higher. So you can see it. Today at the Damascus Gate in Jerusalem opens onto the street, right across a busy street, and it's at street level. But you look over the balustrade going out there, and you can see Hadrian's Damascus Gate 18 feet down. Same area, but 18 feet down. There it is, just showing you exactly what Jerusalem looks like today. And so there are dozens of other places mentioned. At Capernaum, Peter's house has been discovered. A boat's been discovered they could have used. And it just keeps going. This is only in the last 125 years. Think of what's going to happen when 26 digs are working in Israel at all times in the dig season from here on. It's the neatest place in the world to dig because it's very dry. And that's a preservative. And so people stay tuned. There will be additional discoveries that'll, if past is any predictor, will beautifully corroborate the biblical record. And this also means, by the way, not just to compliment the audience, but you people as you sit there, whether or not you know it, because of all these advances being made into exploring the biblical record, you either know more or can know more about how our faith got started than any of the greatest names in church history. You know far more than Martin Luther. Not that you have the command at his disposal and the eloquence of Luther, but your database is bigger, is what I'm trying to say. Luther didn't have archaeology. He would have loved it. You know what kind of a nuts and bolts character Luther was? He'd have run with it, didn't have it. You know more than the great Catholic theologian Thomas Aquinas. You know more probably than St. Augustine himself, the father of the Western Church, didn't know his Greek and the Greek fathers. I kid you not. I maintain that because of 2,000 years of good biblical scholarship, because of the blessings of archaeology, you either know more today or can know more. Your database today is bigger than ever before, except for the eyewitness generation and maybe one or two afterwards. Well, it's got to be enough for me. Do we have any time for questions or not?
We do not.
Maybe not. I'm sorry.
That's all right.
No, you get motor mouth Meyer going. It's terrible. I apologize, team. Fun being with you.
Dr. Paul Meyer. That's Dr. Paul Meyer, Professor Emeritus of Ancient History at Western Michigan University in Kalamazoo, making the case for biblical archaeology at the 2015 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference. Tomorrow on Issues Etc., we'll look forward to Sunday morning talking with Dr. Carl Fekencher about Jesus appearing to Thomas the disciple. We'll hear Chris Rosebro's presentation from the 2015 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, making the case against vision-casting leaders in the church. It should come as no surprise whatsoever that the more we dig and the more we find in biblical archaeology, the more the biblical record is confirmed. We don't depend on biblical archaeology to determine whether or not what the Bible says happened really happened. We know it happened because we are getting the word from God himself. But we shouldn't be surprised when what God says happened and what has been recorded there by inspiration of the Holy Spirit, in fact, turns out to be in evidence. And that's all biblical archaeology does. It just uncovers the evidence of what God has revealed to us and shown us he has done. I'm Todd Wilkin. I'll talk with you tomorrow. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.